Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by contributors from community radio stations across Canada. This episode of Groundwire was produced at CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on the traditional territory of the Ganegahaga, or Mohawk. I'm your host, Laura Charney. On today's show...
One of the most tragic elements is that not only are the people from the blockade who are being sued experiencing a lot of stress and maybe might think twice now, but, you know, people will hear about this and say, oh, well, that's a good reason not to get involved.
You know, how do you feel about sex work? Do you think it's good? Do you think it's oppressive? Do you think it's, you know, an expression of patriarchy or whatever feminist debate we want to have? The question is the police invading sex workers' lives the solution?
Catherine Fisher of CJLY on Sinek's traditional territory in British Columbia brings us the following headline.
The Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives has released a new report on the potential benefits of extending the maximum duration of employment insurance sickness benefits available from 15 to 30 weeks. Sickness benefits are currently capped at 15 weeks, but half of the workers who go on sick leave without later claiming another type of EI reach the 15-week limit before they are ready to return to work. The current cap is especially problematic for women, older workers, and lower-income families who may be disproportionately reliant on sickness benefits. The report found that if sickness benefits were extended to 30 weeks, 9 out of 10 workers forced to go on sick leave could fully recover and return to work before benefits expired, a result that the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives states could provide a large benefit to working people at a reasonable cost. The report, called On the Mend, is available for download on the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives website, policyalternatives.ca.
Michael Welch of CKUW and Gennargi O'Sullivan of CFRO bring us the following headline.
The week of July 23rd, the Assembly of First Nations assembled in Vancouver, the traditional territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh First Nations, for their annual General Assembly. A major controversy springing from the event was the presence of Carolyn Bennett, the Federal Minister of Crown Indigenous Relations, at the AFN's caucus meetings during the election of the National Chief. Co-op Radio's Gennargi O'Sullivan was present at the AFN gathering and managed to get comments from Pam Palmiter, academic, Mi'kmaq lawyer, and past candidate for AFN National Chief.
I think it's completely inappropriate for any federal or provincial high-level minister or deputy minister to be anywhere on the premises when an election is happening, because it can be construed as government interference, undue influence, or even bias from the other candidate. So that's something that should never happen. In an AFN election.
Full coverage of the AFN AGA is available in the cooperadio.org archives for the July 26th show, KLA How Ya FM.
That's it for the headlines. You are listening to Groundwire Community Radio News, available online at www.groundwirenews.ca. We'll be right back after this.
Tú tienes la capacidad. Tú. Sabes que por ti
You just heard La Capacidad by Lito Pimienta from her 2016 album La Papesa. Now it's time for our feature stories. Michael Welch of CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg brings us a piece on the Parker Lands direct action lawsuit. CKUW broadcasts on the occupied Anishinaabeg Akin, the homeland of the Métis Nation and the traditional territory of the Nahiowag and the Nakota.
In July of 2017, a group of community members took part in a peaceful direct action blocking machinery from cutting down any more of the Parkerlands, a patch of urban forest and green space in south-central Winnipeg. The individuals involved in the action argued that the area had been proximate to a former Métis settlement called Roostertown that had been torn down in 1959 to make room for retail and other developments in Winnipeg half a century ago. The activists argued that proper consultations with the Manitoba Métis Federation, among other representative Indigenous groups, were therefore in order before development could proceed on the patch of land. The Roostertown blockade consisted of tents and individuals camped out day and night. The blockade came to an end in mid-September when the developer, through his lawyer, successfully forced the blockaders off the property with an approved court injunction. Much of the remainder of the forest has since been clear-cut. CKUW recently got hold of two of the campers to update us on the situation.
My name is Jasmine Thomas, and primarily in relation to the Roostertown blockade, I'm an anti-racist activist. Particularly, I'm interested in decolonization. And as a white settler, I think it's really important to support these movements.
My name is Nancy Thomas. I'm a business consultant. I work with a lot of groups in social justice issues.
The court injunction came into effect, and so we complied with that. And so we packed up. We left the land, obviously, very sadly. So in early October, nearly 50 of us received notice that we were going to be sued in civil court for various things.
So the developer is suing, first off, for trespassing, but then he's suing us for what you would call economic torts, which are civil wrongs. Like, he's trying to claim that we've harmed his economic interests and delayed his development. Well, as we found out, he is not able to develop anything there at this point in time, and he may never be able to. So he's looking for damages. His lawyer said anywhere from $500,000 to tens of millions of dollars. That's just outrageous. A group, a collective, we call them, of the blockaders or just the involved people, have a lawyer, and they've now brought a motion to strike out significant portions of the claim, meaning they're saying that, there's no cause of action, that the lawsuit is deficient, and they haven't given any material facts where any of us could have anything to do with that.
You had a lot of community members from sort of the area and the neighborhoods surrounding what used to be the Parker Wetlands. And the fact that now some of them are being sued, you know, they're definitely going to think twice before going to a rally or going, you know, donating money to something or showing support because of this. And that's, I think, one of the most tragic elements, is that not only are the people from the blockade who are being sued experiencing a lot of stress and maybe might think twice now, but, you know, people will hear about this and say, oh, well, that's a good reason not to get involved.
Jasmine and Nancy Thomas are referring here to something called a strategic litigation against public participation lawsuit, or a SLAP suit. In an April 2018 article for Briar Patch magazine, James Wilt, freelance writer and fellow defendant in the Roostertown lawsuit, quoted Normand Landry, author of Threatening Democracy, SLAPs, and the Judicial Repression of Public Discourse. Landry explained that with SLAPs, the litigant is less interested in actually winning the case than in wearing out the targets of the lawsuit and intimidating other community members who may wish to engage in similar challenges.
Maybe one positive outcome that could come out of this, besides the lawsuit getting dropped and actually having some accountability for developers, if we could maybe start to push for anti-SLAP legislation that would prevent these strategic lawsuits against public participation.
The remaining activists and land defenders with the Roostertown blockade are soliciting support from the public to help defray their legal costs. A link to their GoFundMe page, among other supports and resources, can be found on the Facebook page Roostertown Blockade at the Parker Wetlands. From Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabeyakin, the homeland of the Métis and the traditional territory of the Nahiowak and the Nakota, this is CKUW's Michael Welch for Groundwire.
In the following feature, Gennarji O'Sullivan of Vancouver Co-op Radio reports from the annual General Assembly of the Assembly of First Nations held in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Section F8, any candidate who fails to gain at least 15 votes shall be automatically eliminated.
I'm Gennarji O'Sullivan, and I, along with 650 other, not that I'm a chief, but there were 650 chiefs at Canada Place witnessing the election, where Perry Bellegarde was re-elected. But before all of that happened, there was a huge controversy around the Honorable Carolyn Bennett, the Minister of Crown Indigenous Relations, and her attendance at the AFN. In more particular, she was present and on site having a dialogue with many of the chiefs during caucuses before the election.
I need a motion from the floor to destroy the ballots. I need a motion from the floor.
Just an update on the latest news about the Assembly of First Nations elections. which happened this Wednesday. Perry Bellegarde won a second term as National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations amid allegations a federal minister interfered in the election. Bellegarde clinched the victory after receiving 328 votes, which pushed him over the 60% threshold needed to win. It took him two rounds of voting to emerge from a field of five candidates. But the election ran into controversy when, amid voting on the first ballot, Crown Indigenous Minister Carolyn Bennett met with Alberta Chiefs. Diabo, a policy analyst from Kahnawake, accused Bennett of interfering in the election. His allegations surfaced between the first and second ballot, creating a brief air of uncertainty.
Thank you. All in favour?
Candidates and past chiefs alike have argued that the AFN is out of touch with grassroots movements. And even as candidates promise to reform the AFN, the question remains, is the AFN even more worth reforming? Some argue that the AFN needs a fundamental restructuring, while others argue that voting changes are the answer. However, the problems that grip the AFN are far deeper than can be addressed through a simple restructuring. The AFN's foundational idea, a national organization with a single grand chief, flattens the landscape of indigenous priorities and reinforces the settler government's power over indigenous governance. Bellegarde talks about modernizing the AFN, which could mean moving away from a structure that relies on colonial provincial borders, but no amount of reform can excise the colonialism at the heart of the AFN. And how can one single leader represent distinct individual indigenous communities? A national First Nations organization is a capitulation to the settler state. It erases our distinct identities and the accountability the federal government has to individual nations via the treaties. The fact that each federal government has been able to use the AFN and its national chief to approve legislation is an attack on individual nations' sovereignties.
Here I am at Canada Place at the AFN AGA, and I'm speaking with Terry Tajji, the Assembly of First Nations BC Regional Chief.
So the recognition of our title has been a struggle for many of our communities to get federal and provincial government to recognize those rights so we can get access to our own resources and be part of the economy. You are right that and even to make decisions as it relates to the United Nations Declaration for the Rights of Indigenous People, free, prior, and informed consent. We're seeing it in the debate of the Trans Mountain Pipeline. Mm-hmm. We're seeing it in different other developments, mining, forestry.
Anti-fish farms,
exactly.
The Shishwatman.
We're at this point that there is commitments to recognize it, like as in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, but it has to translate to the ground. It has to translate to our governments, how we make decisions. It has to translate to how it makes a difference to those children, to our people back in the community.
This whole week, Gary and I have been at the AFN conference at the Canada Place. Every morning they started off with a sunrise ceremony, a pipe ceremony. Everything was done in a good way. They held caucus meetings. Caucus meetings were held in regards to the work that is at hand from nation to nation, from concurrent dialogue sessions about dialogue on potential federal First Nations health issues, to housing and related infrastructure, Jordan's Principle, co-developing of First Nations, Inuit, and Métis languages, and modern-day treaties.
Thanks, Ganarji, for that report. The additional voices you heard in that feature were Sarvanaz Anamat and Derek White Skycloud. Our final feature comes from CKUT in Montreal. Ali Sirois interviewed Sandra Wesley, the director of Chez Stella, about the Protection of Communities and Exploited Persons Act, or the PCEPA, and the current federal government's plans to repeal it.
There seems to be some confusion surrounding PCEPA in that many people think it actually protects sex workers. What have you actually seen kind of or heard from people directly affected by it?
from the very beginning of the PCEPA's inception, sex workers have always been unanimously against it. There was a really, really good marketing campaign by prohibitionists and conservatives to try to misrepresent what it actually does as a law. But what it does is put us all in a lot of danger. So for the first time in Canada under the PCEPA, exchanging sexual services for money is now a criminal act, which it wasn't in and of itself in the past. So every aspect of sex work is now criminalized.
So what have been some of the impacts that you've seen on sex workers or those included in sex work?
It's getting much harder to negotiate with clients because clients being now explicitly criminalized, they feel afraid of interacting with us because they're afraid of getting arrested. So for women working on the street, what this means is that they have to usually jump in the car much faster. In the past, they would take a few minutes to talk to the client, to negotiate price and services. But now because the client is afraid of getting arrested, they usually just jump in the car. And obviously once you're in a moving vehicle with a stranger, it's much harder to negotiate in the power dynamic. Now, at the rental board, the Régie du Logement, because sex work is a criminal act, we've seen a few judgments where sex workers have been evicted simply because they receive clients at home. So because it is a criminal act, it is now considered grounds to evict someone. We see in Montreal, in Laval specifically, they shut down pretty much all the massage parlors in the city in January this year with a municipal bylaw. So we see a lot of different types of risks that sex workers are now taking. And the result is that in 2017, at least 10 sex workers, 10 women sex workers were murdered in Canada. That climate of hatred against sex workers has shifted since the PCEPA. In the past, we were often seen as criminals or people with bad morals or other things of the sort. And now we really see this strong idea that we're victims and that we need to be saved. So our message is that while we disagree completely with that perspective, it doesn't even really matter. These laws put us in danger, so we need to repeal them and decriminalize sex work, regardless of what people think about sex work, and that's a conversation that we try to bring back. So it's not, you know, how do you feel about sex work? Do you think it's good? Do you think it's oppressive? Do you think it's, you know, an expression of patriarchy or whatever feminist debate we want to have? The question is the police invading sex workers' lives the solution to that?
Another major consequence of the PCEPA is limited access to healthcare for sex workers. Elena Argento, a research associate with the Gender and Sexual Health Initiative of the BC Centre for Excellence in HIV/AIDS and a PhD candidate at UBC, focuses on the health impacts of the criminalization of sex work. Argento, who studied 854 cis and trans sex workers, found that before the enactment of the PCEPA, 13% of sex workers could not access health services. Now, post-PCEPA, that number has increased to 18%.
What else does decriminalization look like to you?
So one really, really important point is some changes in immigration rules, because right now in Canada, anyone who doesn't have permanent residency, if they're found in a place where sex work is happening, they're immediately deported. So this puts a lot of women in a lot of danger. There's some groups in Toronto and Vancouver that work specifically with Asian migrant women, and they've done some surveys, and almost 100% of women who didn't have permanent residency said they would never call 911 no matter what happened to them, and they listed robberies and rapes and violence. They're targeted a lot because people know that if they call the police, they get deported. And we see even in Montreal, whenever police do these raids, under the guise of looking for victims, and as soon as they find someone who doesn't have permanent residency, even if they have other status that allows them to be here and to work here, they detain them, refer them to CBSA, and deport them. So we need to change that law as well.
Question about how it works at different levels of government, because PCEPA is federal, if I'm not mistaken, but how does that work at the provincial level also?
Criminal law is federal, so that's why the PCEPA, because it criminalizes sex work, so it's federal. However, provinces get to decide how what instructions they give prosecutors in terms of prosecuting cases. So the province does have the power, even if the government doesn't decriminalize, to instruct prosecutors, for example, not to prosecute sex work laws. And then on the municipal level, municipalities, along with some provincial powers also, regulate police and what specific police services can and can't do. So we have, for example, in Vancouver, the Vancouver Police Department came up with, in consultation with sex workers, with guidelines where they specifically don't enforce sex work laws because they know that those laws are harmful. So that's a power also that's possible on a municipal level. And municipalities also have the power to make bylaws, and they use bylaws a lot against indoor sex workers. So in massage parlors or escort agencies, anyone who works indoors, there's a chance that they might interact with the city to get a business license. The other levels of government could be acting even without the federal government at this point.
That report was provided by CKUT in Montreal on unceded Ganegahaga territory. You are still listening to Groundwire, community news broadcasting from coast to coast to coast and available online at www.groundwirenews.ca.
You're in a trance. Say, who did you think you are to have a chance? You're a no one from a place where everyone knows your face. They come and go away, they know the sun. So you better hang on and hey, you better run. Cause here's your chance and your race is begun.
You just heard You Gotta Run, Spirit of the Wind by Buffy St. Marie and Tanya Tagak. That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced at CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, on the traditional territory of the Ganegahaga. Headlines this week were written by Catherine Fisher, Michael Welch, and Gennarji O'Sullivan. We also thank Ome Salma Rahamtula and Ali Sirwa for their contributions. Music this week was from Lito Pimienta and Buffy St. Marie and Tanya Tagak. For CKUT, I'm Laura Charney. Thanks for tuning in.